So tonight I want to talk about what's called the precepts, but let's kind of give you an overview of where that fits in to everything. So this class has mostly been focused on cultivating this internal awareness, internal experience of what's arising right here, right now. Sound, body, breath, and learning to really listen or sense in a deeper way, a more full, clear way, without a lot of distortion. Developing a sensitivity to our moment's experience. And in doing so, learning to release concept and thought, idea. So learning how in that way of connecting fully and deeply to this moment's experience, what's actually here. And the instructions went from a very narrow focus, like just the breath in one area or just a sound, to including more and more aspects like body sensations, emotions, thoughts. Still staying focused and grounded within the present moment. And then tonight we kind of change really the locus of meditation. What I mean by that is where the meditation is coming from, originating coming from. Instead of it coming from me observing, it's more of me actually receiving, stepping back and receiving everything. It's a little bit like going to a corner, a busy corner, and sitting there. And at first you're watching everything. Let's say you want to watch all the cars which are red and they're what you're zipping by, and then all the cars which are yellow and all the ones which are green. And you're just kind of watching every car, maybe every time a bike goes by or a bus. And it can be a little frenetic because you're trying to catch every single one if you're like following each one. Or you can just sit back, let your gaze be soft and let things just flow right through. And you're kind of seeing the impressions. That's more of how we did tonight's practice, is that choiceless awareness. Now, both of these qualities or types of meditations or really modes of meditation have their place, they have their usefulness. They can also have their drawbacks. And so it's we start to have a better sense as we kind of get more mature in the practice of what's the most appropriate for our minds right now. What's most appropriate for this circumstance that might be going on right now in our minds, in our bodies. When I'm really distracted, when my mind's just all over the place, having a more simple one point of focus is helpful. When I'm more collected and there's kind of a natural stillness, then more of that quality of choiceless awareness might be more appropriate. So there's not one's not better than another. Now tonight, we're going to start to look at how we can translate our practice into our lives. We've been kind of talking about this through various questions that have come up, and I appreciate all those engagements and how do I bring my practice into my life? And that's really a critical piece of the class, and also as your career as a meditator, if you will, is how does your meditative practice help inform your decisions, your choices? How does it show up in your relationships, in your various roles as your work or your retirement or your family or your being in a partner or being a friend, whatever it might be, the hobbies that you do? Those are all roles that come up. And all of those can be potentially transformed and enhanced through your meditative practice. Because you're just more present. I mean, what in your life doesn't benefit from you being more present? It's like allows you to show up and actually you have your eyes open instead of being distracted or disconnected. Now, if meditation didn't translate into how we live, it would have a really limited value. And this is again a common question that comes up is how do I engage in my life? And then how do I engage in the bigger things in my life? Bigger things like social justice. How do I deal with relationship issues? How do I earn a living? Now, the Buddha, when he taught, was very clear that this practice isn't just a meditative practice. It's designed, we have to really look at how we are in the world, how we act in the world, to both enhance our practice and allow our practice to deepen, but also to really benefit everyone else, to really care for everyone else. So meditation is just one part of an overall practice. So the meditation that we've been really focusing on allows wisdom and compassion to start to grow. It really cultivates that. Another name for meditation is bhavana or cultivation. So when that starts to grow in us through our clear seeing, our direct seeing, then we start to have that become more and more of a guiding principle, something that we can kind of check in and trust more and more. It becomes like a view and an intention of how we are in the world. And then that wisdom and compassion translates into how we act. And our actions become more based in non-harm, in kindness, the way that we speak, the act, the way we earn a living. And what I'm describing right now is really the Eightfold Noble Path, one of the fundamental or foundational teachings of the Buddha, part of the Four Noble Truths. Now, this class isn't about trying to convert or make anybody become Buddhist. It's just showing some of the technology of meditation, helping you learn that, regardless of whatever spiritual tradition you have or don't have. And, you know, the Buddhist practice does, it's kind of definitely dovetailed well together. And later today, we'll talk a little bit more about a kind of a ongoing monthly class that you might consider that talks more about Buddhism, if that's something of interest to you, called the Buddhist Essentials. But to talk more right now immediately, I want to focus on ethics or ethical conduct, what's often called the five precepts. So these ethics can be a really charged subject for us, you know, as Westerners for some reason. That maybe as many of us feel wounded by externally enforced ethics and morality, you know, fear and shame are used to motivate us to kind of keep us in line, the sense of guilt and punishment, the idea of sin and sinner. Those are kind of the baggage that we come into our practice. One of my mentors and a very, you know, long-term teacher, Christina Feldman, early on in this kind of Western exploration of these teachings, she wanted to do a class on ethics, you know, retreat with ethics as the topic, and hardly anybody signed up for it. So that's part of what happens is like, oh, you know, I don't want to go into that. But I want to focus, you know, instead not kind of help, kind of hopefully circumvent that if that's coming up for you. And to focus instead on not an external expression of ethics, but much more on the internal relationship to ethics, your own personal internal relationship. Because ethical guidelines can become training and markers or a way to kind of guide your practice, things to notice. You start to sense your internal response in an honest and sincere way. Because as you become more sensitive, it becomes harder and harder to do things which aren't ethical. It's not because someone's told you don't be ethical because you're not a good person if you do. It's because just internally you start to sense the dissonance. It becomes less and less tolerable. It becomes like just very uncomfortable when you start to tell a lie, when you take something that's not, when you're stealing something, when you're harming something. Because it's like it's hard to ignore, you know, your intention. It's hard to know what's present in your mind, in your body, and in your heart. One teacher, Ruth Dennison, said that once you start to practice, you at some point you can't get away with anything. You know, not that there's any big, you know, big brother watching you. It's because internally you just, you know that, oh, wow, I know I was going to tell a lie and I went ahead and said it and if anything was going to go right, and yes, it didn't. You know, and so we kind of see that whole process. And then we start to make those choices earlier to not follow that. And this is really that sensitivity, that cultivation of really, you know, that's why I like to emphasize, okay, you know, sensing the nuances of the breath and the body, you know, learning to listen to our direct experience, and all the skills and techniques we've focused on in these 6 weeks together, they can all be applied to how we live. Like Kelsey's question about how do you talk, you know, how do you be present in the middle of a relationship? I mean, that's a perfect example of how do you bring the mindfulness right into your daily life? Because often our actions really arise from our thoughts and our reactivity, and we may not be fully conscious to what those are until we've actually acted on, and then it's a little too late. Because part of what we learn as meditators is the art of the pause. What I mean by this is Usually we kind of just go from stimulus to response, or just the sense of reaction, reactivity. We start to interject a little bit of space, a little bit of openness between. It may not be actually very much of a time duration, but internally it actually feels quite big. Like, oh, I see something arise, and I see it before I act on it. That's all I'm saying, that you see something before you act on it. Instead of just blurting it out, you sense it. It's like, oh, even before it becomes words, you feel that prick of hurt, like with talking with about Beth's question, is feeling that feeling in the body that generates all the thoughts. You learn to steady with that. So this slows down, helps us pay attention. And this becomes this pause that, and in a quote, he's often quoted as coming from Viktor Frankl, but maybe it was actually Stephen Covey, that between stimulus and response, there is a space. In that space lies our power to choose our response. In our response lies our growth and our freedom. Okay, so between stimulus and response, there is a space. In that space is our power to choose our response. In our response lies our growth and our freedom. Okay, so meditation creates that little bit of space, that little bit of pause, and allows us to be awake and present during that. So this is like if we were the coil of rope example, that we see this coil of rope and we mistake it for being a snake and we create all these thoughts around it. We see the coil and then we start to have that thought, maybe it's a snake. And right there we pause and notice, okay, there's this perception. It's a little dim, it's a little dusk, it's hard to see clearly. There's fear arising. Can I be quiet with that? Can I feel that without needing to add to that, without thinking my way into this whole illusioned reality? So as we start to live based in non-harm, either through intentionality or just through that growing sensitivity, especially through our direct seeing, when it's really directed by our own wisdom and our compassion, something interesting starts to happen. And we start to notice we become quieter internally. That internal chatter starts to quiet down. Because each time we act in a way that's unethical or is not very kind or is based in harm, it creates some internal noise. It's like taking, it's really, it's creates a lot of chatter. Because we feel that there's that sense of dissonance, that sense of we have to look over our shoulders, we have to defend ourselves, we have to, argue or justify. Well, when we do something that's ethical, there's not a whole lot to say. There's just like a sense of kind of settling, like, yes, yeah, this is what's true. This is the true statement. This is someone else's possession. I'm not going to take that. This is the choice of speaking in a kind way versus a way that's harsh or that's false. So that's something to start to notice, that as your ethics start to become more aligned, you naturally become more quiet. Now I want to talk, just briefly touch upon these precepts, and we're going to talk about five tonight, and these are kind of the main ones that we practice as lay people who are not monastics. Monastics may practice hundreds of these precepts, different rules of conduct, but luckily we just have five. And these, as you listen to them, you'll find that they're not just Buddhist. You also hear them in many other, if not all, religions. And remember, as you hear them, that the difference between the external top-down commanding way of presenting them, instead focusing on this internal relationship, this internal way you inform your behavior. It's really informed by your own personal growing wisdom and compassion. And so, a fundamental tool is our meditative skill to listen, to notice, to be present. And so, as I just briefly touch on each one, while I'm talking, this is a nice time to practice. Meditating while you're listening, noticing what arises with them, noticing what arises. Like sometimes I may say one and you feel a tightening or a defensiveness is like, oh, come on, I don't want to give that one up. Or maybe a sense of, relief, a sense of, okay, I can relax into that. And just to notice it, again, that fundamental quality of mindfulness, noticing without judgment, noticing with curiosity, with openness. Now these precepts have this phrasing of undertaking the training. So I undertake the training. And this is the training. You know, it is something that we do struggle with. We can fail as human beings. So it's this intentionality that we're trying to do the best we can. And train from different than shalt not. Again, not the top down, but more of that, you know, taking that personal responsibility. All right, so the first precept is to refrain from killing, to refrain from harm. Now there's a, notice again, your internal reaction to that. So of course, there's the obvious one of killing other human beings or killing animals. But there's often a kind of a gray area for us that there's often some level of critters that we feel it's okay to kill, like mosquitoes or for ticks or spiders or whatever it might be. And just notice how if we really take this in, there's a quality of discounting something else's life, their existence. You know, how quickly the hand smacks that mosquito that's biting you, that's sucking your blood. So pausing with that, seeing if there's another option, another way of working with it. So I'm going to just do a humorous story around this with my own working around this particular precept. And when my daughter, she's like 18 now, but when she was maybe 5 or so, something like that, yeah, maybe even younger, 4. So there's had friends over, you know, preschoolers. And so being protective, I wanted to protect her and her friends. In our backyard, we had this huge hornet's nest, a big, you know, yellow jacket nest that was, you know, about as big as a baseball. And so it was close enough to the ground that I was afraid of the kids getting stung. So I thought, okay, I want to get rid of that nest, but I want to honor this precept. And so being a little foolhardy and not overly wise, I thought, okay, I'll just knock it down and then it'll get discouraged. So only a few of them would get harmed. So I knocked it down and ran away. But they really liked that spot, so they rebuilt the nest in the same spot. So being even more foolhardy, okay, I'm going to knock it down into a garbage can, put the lid on, and then catch and release it into the local park. And somehow I managed to do that without getting stung. So again, I'm trying really hard not to harm these insects. But they really liked that spot and came back again. And so finally, with a heavy heart, you know, I got the can of Raid and sprayed the nest. But by really, you know, reflecting and working with it, it was a completely different experience. I could really feel the sadness and the grief of taking these creatures' life. So yes, sometimes we do have to take other creatures' lives. You know, we have to get rid of termites or pests, things which might cause harm, you know, antibiotics, you know, all these, there's ways that we have to take life. But to take it with, you know, really have that quality of open-heartedness, that quality of really seeing clearly what you're doing and feeling the impact of taking something else's life. And of course, there's levels that, like taking another human's life, that there may never be that choice. That may never be something we would ever want to do or endorse. And again, this is I'm not going to go into like death penalty and all that stuff or pro-life or pro-choice. But just to notice for yourself, you know, where that line is. You know, I don't like to do things like the political piece or those kind of big issues in terms of this is what you should do or shouldn't do. But again, let you have the tools to look for yourself, to be clear in your own self. I certainly have my own opinions about those things, but I'm, you know, that's not part of me as a teacher to share those. So refraining from killing and from harming. So the next one is to refrain from stealing, to refrain from taking that which is not freely offered. And this one, again, there's kind of the big overt things, you know, breaking into someone's house, and stealing a car, or shoplifting. But it's also the kind of the subtle edges which are interesting to play with. And I think I encourage you to play with those subtle ones. You know, maybe as simple as when you go to like Costco and there's samples, you know, how many times do you swing by the sample place? you know, the Costco people, they're kind of watching you, so you can't do too many. But there's the, but there's no one watching. Are you supposed to just take, you know, one and sample it and then decide? And how we can have that edge of maybe taking a little bit more than our share. So there's these subtle ways of exploring this. And noticing this internal noise that when we're taking something that's unethical, we're doing something that's like stealing, taking more than our share, there's often this internal justification that arises. There's an internal noise that's coming. When we decide to not take something, even though we could take it free and clear, no one would notice, there might be a sense of grief of, oh, I really want to give that, get that, but I'm not going to because I know it's not mine. There's a way that we settle, a way that we feel more centered. And it's interesting, you know, having some short-term pain for a greater term sense of ease and open-heartedness, you know, finding something and, you know, turning into lost and found, giving it back to that person. So refraining from killing or from killing and harming, refraining from stealing. The next one is to refrain from sexual harm and misconduct. So, you know, this is one of the big areas in our life. It's just, certainly many people have experienced harm through abuse, through assault, and it's a very real, you know, problem in our society. And certainly that expression of it. And there's also the way that consenting adults sometimes, you know, mix up relationships and, you know, cheat on each other. And those, of course, all cause tremendous pain also, as I know some of you have probably experienced. And there's just this sexuality with your partners. It's like, how much do you see the person as a whole being versus, you know, just as a sexual object? Or looking at other people, do you see them as a whole person versus the sexuality of them? So learning to really, you know, use your sexuality, honor your sexuality, to appreciate it, and to also be wise with it, to be kind with it. Use it as a way to connect with yourself and with others, but not to go into that field of harm around it. So that's the third precept. The fourth precept is to refrain from lying, from saying what's not true, the falsehoods. And so there's an internal gauge around this that you can start to feel when you're saying something untrue, your body is going to be telling you stuff about it. It's going to be tight. It's going to be contracted. It's going to be uncomfortable. When you're saying something that's true, even though it might be something that you're maybe embarrassed about or not sure how it's going to be received, it may still feel turbulent, but you also kind of feel that sense of alignment, of connecting with what's actually true. And this is going to be a really powerful one to play with is, you know, what if I didn't speak what's untrue, if I really spoke what's true in the moment? And there's the overt, you know, there's the big lies and there's just the subtle lies. When people, you're having a terrible day, nothing is going right. And people ask, how are you doing? And you say, fine. You know, that's a little bit of a lie. There's a little bit of a disconnecting with how things actually are. So maybe, you know, you don't want to go into all details, but you see things could be better. You could say something that's non-committal, you know, just kind of gauge how things go. And it's interesting because practice is really, you learn how to see things directly, how to connect with things, how they actually are. So again, this becomes more and more important in our lives. And then finally, the last precept is to refrain from substances and that cause intoxication that lead to heedlessness. Okay, so substances, drugs, drinks that lead to a quality of intoxication and heedlessness. So intoxication, you know, being completely, you know, intoxicated, drunk, stoned, it makes it much easier for all these other precepts to be broken. It's easier to cause harm, to kill, to steal, to misuse our sexuality, because we lose that judgment. We lose that sense of discernment. We lose access to our wisdom and our compassion. And so the way I tend to hold these this particular precept is not a sense of complete abstinence, but more of a wise discernment. Like, what level do I start to lose that heedfulness? What time do I start to become less able to make good choices? You know, so some level of alcohol or drinks, you can still enjoy yourself and still be present. And at some edge, it shifts. You know, so just to know that and play with that. And of course, with this particular precept, you know, it's not about prescribed medication. It's really about these ways that we alter our minds through substances. So these five precepts are refraining from harm, from killing, from stealing, to refrain from sexual harm and misconduct, and to refrain from lying and substances that cause intoxication and heedlessness. So life is constantly giving us these choices, you know, to act in a wise way or unwise way. And these ethical trainings kind of give us a benchmark to kind of play with, things to become more aware of, to kind of highlight, how am I with wise speech, with truthful speech? You know, do I act from compassion or from hatred? Do I act from non-harm or from harm? And between stimulus and response, there's a space. And in that space is our power to choose our response. In our response lies our growth and our freedom. So this pause, this space, we cultivate as meditators. And this starts to turn all our life into a learning opportunity. The very struggles, the very things that we kind of rub up against. It's the basic attitude, it doesn't really matter what's here, but can I see it clearly? Can I meet it? Can I understand it? Can I meet it with a steady attention and non-judgmental attention? And then the right action arises from that. What I mean by the right action, an action that's kind, that's ethical, that's wise. So in this way, we start to realize, okay, whatever arises, we can meet that, we can meet it with as much wisdom as is possible. And to realize that we all fall down to these, and we just try to learn from that. And then over time, we become more and more clear with our own patterns, our own understanding. And being around other people who are also practicing this way is so supportive, because you can share, like, oh, I really struggle with this one. How are you doing with it? And you can just start to really bolster each other's practice and lives. All right, let's just sit quietly for a moment to let those words settle.